These discussions are critical, and I want to welcome everyone today. Clearly, these are on your mind. So let's begin. Without further ado, Professor Matthew Watson has agreed to speak first, and I really appreciate this. He'll be speaking about taking the classroom into the community. Now, Matt, I have known for many years, and I won't say too much to begin, but it's very much worth telling the group now that he's been very, very influential in international political economy for several reasons, and this is the area that I'm supposedly working in. He basically reminded us to read the political economists who'd been frequently left out in discussions of political economy today. So what this meant is a real return to thinking about what Adam Smith said and what his points were and how these kinds of ideas are infused sometimes into common sense today. So the work that you've been doing recently, Matt, really looks at the market actors, the way that we find ourselves behaving as market actors sometimes in ways that almost demonstrate the kind of assumed external components of for how behavior occurs and how institutions are set up. So this kind of this reconfiguration, this constant kind of reaccumulation process that becomes so very difficult to get outside of. And I think, and your research is reminding us to think critically about these issues, to take ourselves outside of that hegemonic framework. And the work that you're doing now is looking at uneconomic economics and the obstacles to a sustainable recovery. So some research at the moment. The political economy of international capital mobility and foundations of international political economy. Again, he's also been very active within the International Political Economy Group, which is, of course, IPEG. And again, I want to thank Matt Watson for coming today. And again, welcome. Thanks very much. Over to you.
Thank you very much, Phoebe. That's an exceptionally kind introduction. You're absolutely right, though, that the things that we're talking about today are things that relate both to the academic work that I've done, but also to the way that I want to imagine my own role as an academic. The issues that we are going to be discussing are issues that have increasingly exercised my mind over a number of years now. My partner Katie would have an easy answer for that. She thinks that I ask the question why as often as a four-year-old does. And I think that probably is true, actually. But it is easy to keep asking the question why when you realise just how much your job has changed over the not all that long that I've been doing it. I've been doing it for quite a while. I am a 20th century academic after all. My career started before the turn of the century. And many of the things that brought me into academia in the first place are still the things that keep the job attractive to me despite all of its changes. The ability to be there in the classroom, to have the discussions with the students, to engage them, not only on what I see as being the most important aspects of contemporary life, but to engage them into thinking more deeply about their own lives, to see the implications of them challenging their own visualization techniques, the way that they begin to look at society and to think about society. We have student cohorts going through at the moment who are living through some tumultuous times, and the opportunity that we therefore have to help them shape their own understanding of the times that they go through is still a genuine pleasure. I do derive that pleasure from my job. I still see it as a real privilege as well to be allowed to do that job. And I also see this constant questioning attitude being really useful when I can turn it back in on myself and allow it to inform the sort of research that I'm doing, in particular for my ESRC project at the moment called Rethinking the Market. It allows me to challenge my own perceptions and my own preconceptions about the social forces that help to shape the world in which we live. So there are still some things about the job that stay the same. I think Maureen was absolutely right. When it comes to the classroom, we have total control still about the flows of information that pass between us and our students. We can construct our courses in the way that we see fit, and that obviously gives us a number of political opportunities. But there are things that have changed, of course, and what's changed most, obviously, is the context in which all this takes place. The great campus novels of the 1970s, Malcolm Bradbury's The History Man, David Lodge's Changing Places, they seem like an altogether different world to me, and because of the simple reason that they are. They describe a pace of academic life that was already long gone before I started my career. So I am a 20th century type of person, but not that much of a 20th century type of person. I was still working my way through infant school in Lincolnshire at the time that these great novels were published. I guess I was the first of the RAE generations. This is the way that people of my age, I think, have to think of themselves in the longer history of the way that academia has evolved. So those people that knew not only that we would be held to account for the public money that would be used to fund our research, but also that we knew that other people would be using those same structures to try to plot our career possibilities for us. So I think there is a significant change for people of my generation who grew up into the job fully aware that these mechanisms would be used as forms of oversight on us. I think we were probably the first generation of academics to really have to come to terms with understanding performance indicators as the new normal. And those performance indicators, of course, have increasingly been harnessed to supposed market testing. The whole world, apparently, has become a consumer. And of course, what do consumers like? Consumers like choice. But do we give them full scope to exercise their choice? No, of course not. One of the most pernicious things that's happened, not only in our sector, but across the public sector, is the development of the league table society. So politically, the consumer is placed on some sort of pedestal. But of course, we don't trust the consumer enough to make their own choices for themselves. We give them a set of often specious league tables as a means of guiding their choices for them. And apparently everyone in the context of higher education now is a consumer of this nature. Apparently we as academics are meant to take these league tables into account when making our decisions about where to work. I'm absolutely sure that that is the very last thing that crosses our mind when we make those decisions. But nonetheless, the image of the academic job market becoming some sort of artifact of the relevant league table is the one that now predominates. This feeds down into our students as well. Our students are also meant to take these league tables into account when they decide where they're going to spend either their money or their parents' money on accessing higher education. So the student recruitment market also seems to become increasingly an artifact of the relevant league table. So it's the encroachment of these market norms that's changed our professional experience and changed it most obviously. I'm still extremely surprised almost on a daily basis at how much these market norms have come to influence not only the way in which I'm required to do my job, not only the targets that are set for the job that I do, but also how they influence the language that's used around the university, the way that the market vernacular encroaches into everything from research committee discussions through to student open days. However, I've not come here this morning to try and tell you all these things that you already know from your own experience, and neither have I come here to try to depress you with one bad news story after another. That's the job of the weather forecasters these days, isn't it? Because today's a celebration, I think. It's a celebration of our right to always think that things might be different. In general, however much we're subjected to market ideology, to market vernacular, we have to keep one thing very clearly in mind. Markets are not a simple one-way process. And there's no reason to presume that markets in higher education have to be reconstructed as a simple one-way process either. Market ideology might be presented in increasingly all-encompassing terms, but we know that market reality can never be so homogenised. And this is not just a case of winners and losers seemingly being picked by markets. This is also about deliberately being able to poke a finger in the eye of market convention. And hopefully we can begin to explore today some of the possible sites within our professional experiences where that sort of deliberately non-conformist activity can be harnessed to good effect. What's been shown within the literature that I work in anyway is that whenever there's an attempt to enforce new market rationalities, alternative behavioural spaces are also opened up. And they're opened up so that it becomes possible to act against those market rationalities. Whenever a new market vernacular develops to structure the way that we're told to think about the world, it also offers opportunities. It becomes possible to show how that market vernacular might be corrupted, how it might be satirised, how it might be undermined to mean something entirely different, how it might be moulded to fit an alternative conception of what social reality might be about. Not all of our activities, and I guess this is my main message of the few minutes that I have, not all of our activities have to obey the same market logic, even if it's very difficult to imagine now how we might be able to escape the encroachment of market norms altogether. So this brings me to what I'd actually promised to talk about this morning, which is taking the classroom into the community. Probably better to read it off that slide rather than that slide, which doesn't make a lot of sense.
They're coming to fix it, I think.
One of the extra requirements on all institutions today, of course, is to make more effort on widening participation, which increasingly seems to have taken on a capital W and a capital P. Reporting on this, of course, is now part of being allowed to enter the market on the income side of our activities, the market for student recruitment. Not that we really have anything that looks like a choice in that respect. But there's always a danger that widening participation with a capital W and a capital P can collapse into a bureaucratic rather than an educational initiative. It can become, it doesn't have to, but it can become about ticking the right boxes, about filling the right quotas, about opening up new income streams. That would be hugely worrying if that's what widening participation with a capital W and a capital P does become. What I'm talking about here this morning, I think, is something different, maybe a little W and a little P for widening participation. This is more about more than recognising that a new market-oriented higher education system can complete with enhanced barriers to entry. We know that's true, and we know it's important to recognise that, and we know that it's also important to try to find efforts to overcome those barriers. But it's also about recognising that this in itself is symptomatic of broader changes in the way that society is organised, broader changes that have resulted from the increasing encroachment of market institutions into perhaps all areas of everyday life. And there are significant numbers of people out there for whom widening participation with a capital P and a capital W is not going to reach them. It's not going to bring them into the university because that's not the sort of life that they understand is possible for themselves. But it doesn't mean that we can't find ways of taking the university out to them. Even if it becomes impossible to imagine everyone having access to the types of discussions that we have in our routine day-to-day job, we can take those discussions on the road. We can make them much more mobile, and hopefully we can engage a broader section of community by doing so. So there are significant numbers of people out there for whom university is not necessarily the normal destination, but who have nonetheless had their aspirations, knowledge and life chances all dramatically shaped by the changes that have come with an increasing adoption of the market world. We do have some sort of knowledge about that, and it's knowledge that we can impart in new and novel ways to people who might never experience the inside of a university in any normal sense. These are people who have seen the political economy of their daily lives impacted very, very severely by changes to economic policy over the last 30 or 40 years. The political economy, the extension of the market form, is also the political economy of these people's daily lives. It's about enhanced discipline. It's the increasing tendency for them to be told that they, their character, or their lifestyle is somehow deficient, wrong even. The political economy of market conformity and of market exclusion is also the political economy of these people's daily lives. This is about enhanced resignation that life must now always be like this. The political economy of market breakdowns is also the political economy of these people's daily lives. Their enhanced vulnerability to events that are beyond their control. The political economy of precarity is also the political economy of their daily lives, the enhanced difficulties that they experience in making ends meet. This is a whole group of people for whom knowledge about the economy, knowledge about the market world, is exceptionally important. It's exceptionally important because it tells them things about their life. And these are people that I think it is possible for us to seek to engage. One of the most poignant aspects of the ongoing crisis, for instance, is that its effects are lived in direct proportion to the individual's ability to pass them on to someone else. So what we see is a complete break between culpability for those events and bearing the costs of them. There is blame switching going on here at a remarkably high level. Blame switching has always been a political device, but I think it's become the new normal in politics. It's here with a vengeance. And there are people that we can help to self-educate about their own lives so that they feel less as if they are to blame for the things that are going on around them. So the ability to pass off the cost of the crisis onto someone else takes three different things. It takes power, it takes resources, it takes good luck. There are lots of people out there in the community who lack all three. And because they lack all three, they're being required to shoulder the burden of the blame in a way that's way out of proportion with their responsibility for causing it in the first place. When you're permanently backed into a corner and told repeatedly that it's your fault, it's easy to internalise that blame and to turn it into something that it should never be. Now, one of the things that academic research has done so well in the wake of the crisis is to highlight the increasing divergence between the essential materiality of the crisis and its political narration. It was, still is, and always will be, a financial crisis. But how often are we now told that politically in amongst all the seeming homilies to balance budgets and good housekeeping and having a state that doesn't act beyond its means? The whole essence of this as a financial crisis is in danger of getting lost. Now, we can help to close that gap by telling it like it is, and also by making sure that we're there to help engage the people who might otherwise blame themselves for a crisis that was no part of their making. Now, this means exploiting the alternative behavioural spaces opened up by the increasing marketisation of higher education to think about how we can extend the sector's new and often rather instrumental concern for widening participation with a capital W and a capital P into something else, maybe into forms of community education where the widening participation becomes with a little W and a little P. The demand's certainly there for these new forms of community education. I'm sure as the day progresses, we're going to hear more and more about the uptake from some of the groups that are actually delivering this in practice already. There are so many people today who want to know more about how the economy works because they're dissatisfied with the explanations that they get about how the economy works, both from politicians and from orthodox economics opinion itself. From politicians, the blame the victim culture has become so rooted, so embedded now, that it's very difficult to get a straight answer for anything in relation to economic policy. And from orthodox economics opinion, well, they should still be railing from the fact that no orthodox economist really saw the crisis coming, but they've managed to wriggle their way out of this, explaining the crisis away not as something that they didn't foresee, but as something that was essentially unforeseeable. Because who can be blamed for not being able to see something that can't be seen? So what we have now is a purely technical explanation from economics of the crisis as a multiple standard deviation event that's so statistically rare that it isn't worth giving too much thought to. Think of a normal distribution, add some fat tails onto that, explain the crisis away as the fattest of all fat tails, and you don't need your visualization technique attuned to them at all. These are just things that happen and everyone else can adjust to it. Now, in terms of explaining the crisis, this is about as much use as the proverbial chocolate teapot. But what it does have is important political effects because it allows the politicians to continue to pass the blame for the crisis onto people who had no role in it happening. So what I hope we can begin to do as a sector, despite all the pressures that we're on we're under in terms of our day-to-day life, is to think about additional ways of trying to help the truly disenfranchised, the truly excluded, in a process maybe of quiet self-education. This would be one of the goals that I hope I can set myself, and I hope also that the sector would be willing to try to embrace. Certainly we have lots of ability to facilitate this type of quiet self-education. And I think it would really begin to bear dividends. Participants in community education programmes, for instance, are actively involved in reclaiming knowledge of the economy from some of the more esoteric principles of academic economics. Academic economics has lapsed into a conversation amongst specialists, where what they're discussing in general are problems that are self-made by the economists themselves. Not problems as they are experienced by normal people in their everyday lives. So community education, I think, can fill some sort of gap here. It can allow people to learn more about their own lives and also how their lives are connected to other people's through the economic decisions that they themselves make, but also through the economic decisions that other people make that then rebound on them and on their lives. The very notion of an economic system can consequently get liberated from orthodox demand and supply diagrams and becomes something that people actually feel they're living in their own experiences. I think this would be an exceptionally useful and repoliticising way of thinking about the economy. It's about inclusiveness. There's an inclusiveness principle here to allow people to talk about the economy in non-abstract, non-technical ways that make sense to them in terms of how they live their own lives and the struggles that they have to make ends meet within those lives. So there's a very important inclusiveness principle running all the way through these activities. I think it stands in direct contrast to the exclusion brought about by the marketisation of higher education. But to my mind, at any rate, these two things go hand in hand. We now have people to talk to in community education groups precisely because they occupy these alternative behavioural spaces that are opened up in parallel to the marketisation that's happened within higher education. And if that helps to explain the optimism that I still have about the fact that there's demand out there for taking the classroom into the community, there's also clearly the means. Those means do exist, and they do exist usually through the technology that we increasingly use both at work and outside of that. Now, I am probably the last person here to stand up praising technology. The people that know me best, and Nick's already laughing, will know that my own relationship with technology is not particularly deep. I'm perhaps still the only person in the room never to have owned a mobile phone, I would imagine. I do have this grumpy old man attitude that takes over whenever the musings of the Twitterati appear in front of me. And don't even bother asking me about Facebook. That just looks like a spelling mistake to me. I have no idea whatsoever. But nonetheless, just because I am a bit of a techno-idiot, it doesn't mean that the technology itself isn't there and can't be exploited. There's certainly a sense in which we can take ourselves and our classrooms into the community, that we can volunteer to run sessions in spaces that are somehow beyond the market, that don't require people to act in line with market rationalities to access those spaces. It's also the case that we can begin to open up brand new spaces altogether of a virtual nature using technological means. Now, technology itself, we're presented with it often in our working lives as a means to try to enhance our relevant league table position. Can we use technology to have this constant interaction with students, to bump up their contact hours, to allow them to think good things about us, which will give us a better place on the relevant league table, and they and subsequent generations of students might be willing to part with a lot of money subsequently to come to our classes. These routes to accessing potential students tell us nothing, though, about who those students are, nor yet about the content of the information flow. And I think that we can use the technology in new, novel, and often quite radical ways. I think we can station virtual classrooms throughout the community through two things. Firstly, by extending what we mean by a student, to break the link between student and fee payer. Obviously, we're not going to forget our actual students who are fee payers, and we must be attentive to their needs. Clearly, that's the case. But there are also potential students out there who can benefit from the knowledge that we're able to share with them who are not fee payers themselves. And secondly, we can take the message that most of us are likely to deliver about the market world to our fee-paying students anyway, the message to think, to challenge, to question, to resist, and we can use that and make sure that it goes further afield into these virtual classrooms. In conclusion then, because I see I've only got a couple of minutes left, I'm not sure that I have any great answers to the predicaments we'll be talking about today, only ideas about how it might be possible, at least partially, to fight back, to try to invert some of the logics that are presented to us. If I could, I would happily remove neoliberalism from education completely. Unfortunately, I know that this is not in my gift. What I can do, though, is hopefully think through some of the implications of identifying alternative behavioural spaces that open up within all market arrangements. If there's one message to take home from what I've been talking about for the last few minutes, it's about trying to understand ways of pricing those new behavioural spaces even further apart, trying to open them up as wide as possible, trying to allow them to be populated by as many people as possible for who university is not necessarily a normal part of their life. It is possible, I argue, to make those spaces resonate with a very different approach to the idea of what education is all about. Dare I say it, maybe even to return it to something that more clearly resembles what I remember thinking my job was going to be about when I first started doing it. Community education initiatives have much to commend them in this regard. The task now, as far as I can see in any case, is to develop strategies for fleshing out these alternative behavioural spaces that necessarily exist in the interstices between higher education markets, and to do so increasingly with a potentially radicalising political content, one that can be shared as widely as possible within the community. And let's hope we can make a good start on those discussions today. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Matt.